Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And we're going to continue the explorations of the cultures of consciousness. Today we're making a fun and exciting leap between body and spirit. We're going to explore it in, I think, rather fresh ways, rather innovative ways. Our guest today is Connor Habib. And just to tell you a little bit about him, in a couple of weeks or a month or so, he's going to be doing an event on the Evolver Learning Lab, you know, associated with the Reality Sandwich magazine, where he also writes. And he's doing something on anthroposophy, Rudolf Steiner, freedom, and the Western esoteric tradition. And we'll be talking about that. Haven't had too much Steiner on this show. I admit I'm not a super Steiner buff. Don't know him that well, and I'm looking forward to learning some more from Connor, who's a good presenter, a good writer, and you know has been becoming more and more present in terms of his esoteric interests. But Connor is also a gay porn star, and that conjunction sets off all sorts of very interesting things that I think illuminate a lot about where we are in our culture, about porn, about the body, about sex, about spirit, and the interconnections between all of these things and so many other things. So I'm looking very much forward to our conversation and just to find out some of the things that are going on in Connor's life, because as you might imagine, his zone that he's occupying or moving into in the world raises all sorts of issues for all sorts of people. And so it's fun to see the world through his eyes. But before that, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. Hey, so you're going on a retreat next week. You're not going to be on the show next week because you're going to be on a mountaintop.
It's true. I'm totally going to be on the top of Devil's Backbone at Mount Baldy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is it a Zen retreat? I know they have a Zen center up there.
Well, it's just me, actually. I'm not doing it with anybody else.
Oh, I misunderstood.
Gotcha. It's actually around the time the Aetherius Society, you know, we've had Paul Nugent on the show before. They and a lot of other people view Mount Baldy as one of the spiritual sites, and it's where their master, George King, like received his kind of attunement or whatever you want to call it. So they've been going up there for the past couple weekends, and they're doing another big tivuti, but I'm going to miss it because I can't go. So I'm just going to go by myself and do a lot of meditation and hiking and getting into nature and all that kind of thing. I'm so excited for it. I can't wait.
Well, that's what we were talking about. You know, it's so hard to, you know, even when you can technically make the time happen, which isn't the case for everybody, but even when you can, it's so hard to set aside that kind of time. And you know, it's not the same thing as a vacation. Like I just got back from a vacation.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. I did some talks, I you know, saw some sights, I saw old friends, had a lot of experience, you know, felt that way that you feel alive and stimulated on vacation. And then I got back and I was like, man, I need a retreat.
Exactly.
You know, so are you staying in a cabin or a tent?
I'm totally going to be in a cabin on the mountain. You know me, I'm a total nature girl. I grew up on an island in the woods, so I am so excited to just be surrounded by trees and nature. I can't wait.
Yeah, well, while we'll miss you on the show next week, I'll be happy to imagine you in the kind of environment that...
I'll send you some mountain vibes.
Excellent. Well, with that, let's bring on Connor Habib to the show. Connor, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Hey, Eric. How you doing?
Pretty good. It's good to have you on the show. I was just rereading your essay in the collection. I think we're both in that collection. Exploring the Edge Realms of Consciousness, the Reality Sandwich bit. And, you know, there's a lot of different directions we can go in. You know, there's the discussion of your background, what's going on right now. It seems like it's a real exciting year for you. You got a lot of things going on, but we could also just dive right into like one of the core questions that I think you're raising in the essay in that book, and that you're kind of exploring in your public and professional publicating life, which is the relationship between body and spirit. And in that book, that essay, you say something really interesting that I never really thought about in quite the same way, which is, you know, you're directly talking about some of the issues that people have with pornography. And, you know, most of the defenses of pornography that I'm familiar with, because I grew up in an age of the kind of pro-porn feminist moment, and so the idea that pornography could be a zone of celebration and pleasure and even politics is something very familiar to me. But I'd never really heard a sort of, if you will, spiritual defense of what it reveals about the way in which, you know, however much we're experiencing beings, we're also bodies and we're also objects in the world for other people. And that there's this play between being an object and being a subject that's actually part of a rich, multidimensional life. So I'm just really curious, like, how you came to start to think about these things, and how you what was happening in your life when you started to really feel the need to kind of understand the deeper dimensions of the experience of working in porn and thinking about what it means.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's funny because as you're, like, formulating your question out loud to me, like, my thinking shifted a little bit because, you know, when I wrote that essay, really I was just sort of trying to do sort of let's think deeper about this idea of objectification, which people throw at pornography all the time. And, you know, what does that even mean? I mean, don't we have a material aspect to ourselves? So, like, aren't we in some sense, you know, partly object anyway? So why is this, you know, a bad thing? And, but, you know, as you're asking me the question, it just occurs to me, like, you know, my spirituality has always been tied into concerns with the material world, concerns with matter. And a lot of that has to do with that being the sort of thrust of anthroposophy, which is spiritualizing the material and materializing the spiritual. And that's why anthroposophy is so concerned with science and materialism. And, you know, I actually came to my, you know, spiritual path really through studying science. You know, I studied science in grad school, and that led me to anthroposophy eventually. So, I mean, I think that it's sort of a broader concern with just materiality in general. So it's not.
Let's go into that, because I was really interested when I was reading more of your bio to see that you studied with and clearly had a very close connection with Lynn Margulis, who I was familiar with again from reading similar kinds of material. These connections between new ways of thinking about evolution and its relationship to system and to spirit, but she's, you know, a solid scientist, made some very important contributions to our understanding of evolution that were quite radical when she first announced them, and gradually became to be seen as you know, part of the evolutionary picture, this emphasis on symbiosis or whatever. So I was like, oh wow, I didn't realize that Connor had kind of a science background. I'm really curious how studying science, even in that open-spirited way, you came toward something that is still, you know, very esoteric, mystical, not just remaining in the realm of science. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how your interest in materiality in a scientific sense unfolded into the interest in Steiner and anthroposophy.
Right. Well, I mean, I would almost say that some of it's like weirdly karmic. You know, I was raised very aspiritually. My father's from a little village in the mountains in Syria, where it's just sort of a loose combination of gypsy beliefs, and Christianity, and you know, my mother was raised very fundamentalist in a very fundamentalist household, so none of them really cared that much to, you know, like, have me do anything sort of religious or spiritual. But I was always interested in it, and so I think maybe that's, you know, I bring that part up just to say, like, there might be something, you know, beyond me or my personality that's caused this interest. But then also, I was always interested, you know, as a kid in science, and, you know, picking up rocks and looking at bugs all day and all that kind of stuff. So I went to grad school and for creative writing, and then Lynn Margulies was at my school. I knew who she was. I had sort of admired her work, admired the fact that she had written so much popular science. So, you know, I walked up to her and said, hey, can I, you know, I'm in the creative writing program. Can I take one of your classes? And she said, what does this have to do with environmental evolution? She was very brusque at first. And then, you know, eventually I ended up studying with her for 3 years. And as he said, you know, I became very close with her. So at some point during that time, she started taking me to all these like science conferences with her. And there was a brochure for this place called the Nature Institute, which is in New York State. They had a 3-month program on Goethe's vision and method of science. And I didn't know Goethe had anything to do with Rudolf Steiner or anything like that. And Lynn said, oh, that's a great place. If you can go there, you just have to go. If you can get into that 3-month program, you just have to go. So, you know, when Lynn told you to do something, you just did it. And I went there, and I was there for... I mean, I was there for 3 months every day. I was also in grad school for science and creative writing and also teaching in another state at the same time, so I was back and forth a lot. And, you know, I found myself in New York with an apartment that was across the street from a Waldorf school and next to a biodynamic farm, literally next door to a biodynamic farm, literally across the street. And so suddenly I was just soaking in all this Rudolf Steiner stuff. And it just sort of brought together all these interests. It just sort of folded them all together. So sort of the more mysterious question to me is, like, why did Lynn tell me to go there? I mean, yeah. She's dead now, so I'll never know. But for some reason, I mean, she claimed to be a total atheist and materialist, you know? So it's interesting. I don't know why she sent me there. And I know that she did respect Rudolf Steiner, and I know that James Lovelock, who she formulated the Gaia hypothesis with, is also very interested in Rudolf Steiner. So, I mean, they would never call themselves anthroposophists, but I don't know. It's a weird question.
What? Well, she was, you know, just to say a little bit about her, because she was a remarkable person, is that she kind of became friends with this interesting network, you know, through William Irwin Thompson,
right,
and Francisco Varela, and these people. There was a sort of world there kind of starting in the 70s, but really flowering in the 80s, with people thinking about Gaia, thinking about systems theory. And one element of it was very esoteric. I mean, William Irwin Thompson's work as a cultural historian included a lot of the sort of mystical material and mythic consciousness. And he did it in a very supple way, very rich kind of way. I'd love to get him on the show at some point. He's still cranking it away. And one of the things that he was able to do, clearly, was to bring scientists and connect with scientists who had enough interest or resonance with that material to feel comfortable in those, in the kind of colloquia they would have and the books they would put out, even without making it seem like they had to become, you know, esotericists. And so there's a beautiful spot there that seems to me that Steiner's work really kind of, you know, feeds into. And so I thought maybe, just, you know, for shits and giggles, you could say a little bit about what was it in Steiner's thought and approach to matter in particular and science that drew you. What was different than the kind of popular science that you were also reading, or the other kinds of books about nature and your own experiences with nature? What was it that was being brought into the conversation that seemed richer to you?
Right. Just to jump back just a tiny bit, I mean, I also just want to say, you know, about Lynn, and then I think this is something about a lot of people who find themselves ultimately into Rudolf Steiner or whatever, is, I mean, she, even though she claimed to be a materialist, she also was very into literature, very into philosophy. She was a very multidisciplinary person, and I think people who embody a lot of what we're told are seemingly contradictory aspects of their personality often end up finding an interest in the occult or finding an interest in esotericism. So I think that that's part of it. I do think that, I remember having this moment with Rudolf Steiner that sort of clicked for me when it came to matter. This is sort of a sideways way of talking about it, but he said, you know, we sort of have this idea that that there's not an inner reality to a lot of the sort of the projections we put onto the physical world. So like geometry and that sort of stuff, we sort of think of it as ways to measure things. But actually, if you experience shapes, so if you walk in a circle or you walk in a square or you walk in a star shape, walking in those patterns feels different than projecting those patterns onto the world. You have each of those patterns has a different sort of inner gesture, and it gives us a different sort of inner feeling. Now, that's sort of a very dim, it's sort of a dim concept to me. But I know that if I walk in a circle, I get a different feeling than if I walk in a square, than if I walk in a star. And so that was this first, little hint of, oh, there's, an inner meaning to every outer application and every sort of, physical system of measurement. It inspires a different feeling in me. And this is an Emersonian thing, too. Emerson would say it's not only words that have meaning, it is also things that have meaning. Everything in the natural world is a metaphor for the human mind or something like that. I'm probably getting a little wrong there. But I think when I started understanding that through Steiner, I started thinking, okay, so what is the phenomenology? What is my inner experience of all the objects around me, of all the stuff around me, of all the things that we're trying to measure? And then what is the phenomenology of our systems of measurement? What does that inspire inside of me? All that kind of stuff. And is that, I think sort of mainstream science sort of just dismisses those inner feelings as, oh, well, that's just sort of like the ornamentation,
Right. It's a real key. I mean, I think about this relationship all the time. I mean, just even when I'm going through my ordinary day, but also intellectually, is that we really have, been brought up with this assumption, this sort of underlying, unspoken, axiomatic truth that there's physical things out there, nature that is described by science, by equations and measurements and models and theories. And then we are on this inside projecting all of our meanings, but they're just projections. They're just like little film cameras we walk around projecting onto this alien, impersonal matter that can only be spoken about truthfully by science. And even when you start to recognize how screwy that is, how problematic it is intellectually, politically, ecologically. I mean, there's all sorts of ways to get it, that we could get into an intellectual discussion about that. But leaving those questions aside for a moment, just how much we have absorbed that model, how much that's sort of the given way that we experience the world in the West, so that you have to do a lot of work even to get to the place where you can start going no, wait a second, I actually have a relationship with this tree. Or, no, wait, actually, redness is not just something that my brain is constructing out of a mere frequency in the natural world. It's more complicated than that. It's richer than
that. Well, and that's what Goethe's work did with it, and where, a lot of the things you were talking about, Connor, those teachings from Steiner were given by Goethe and his idea of the plants and sacred geometry and how, there was this archetypal plant that kind of contained all the shapes and possibilities of all things, and we all have all of those inside of us and relate directly to them, not indirectly or, like Eric said, as a projection or an external thing. And I personally feel like it was Darwin's evolutionary theory that jacked it all up, whereas Goethe had an evolutionary theory that, no, these archetypes are present and endogenous in every single piece of matter and thing. So it's not even like we relate to it, but you are it because you contain it inside yourself, which I don't know if that makes sense. But But that, so that difference, Eric, that you're talking about was exactly what Goethe was trying to delineate. And then his teachings just fell out of favor after Darwin came, and then everyone kind of went the other direction, you know?
Right, and that's, I mean, I think all that sort of speaks to, just to sort of loop it back to the essay that you had mentioned in the beginning, Eric, that, you know, I wrote this sort of, it was just sort of like a clever throwaway line, but it's actually the line that people sort of come to me with more than anything. So, which is, you know, if you think pornography objectifies people, science is the most objectifying force in the entire world. So, like, why aren't we talking about that? So, like,
yeah.
If you want
to
talk about
that. I've never made that connection. I think about this stuff all the time. It's a beautiful, quip.
Yeah. So, for me, like, this idea of, well, if I view the body and material differently, then I don't have the same problems engaging. Like, if you have a completely different scientific worldview, or a completely different worldview that brings science in a different way, or brings the whole idea of materiality and objects in a different way, then your encounter with pornography and sex is going to be very different than someone who just sees everything as objects anyway. It would really change your worldview about sex and everything. And so, I don't know. There's still a block there. I mean, there are lots of people who say they're anthroposophists, and they are anthroposophists, but lots of people who say they're anthroposophists are very uptight about sex. And part of that is because Steiner never left any indication about sex, and lots of anthroposophists like to build everything off of what Steiner said, which I don't do that. But I think, like, so there's still a block there. There's still something happening there. There's still an overwhelming culture intervening with this object idea, this object thinking. So, yeah.
Well, here, I want to jump into a sex and spirit question. It's a little bit different than this object issue, although I do think that has something to do with the answer to the question that I'm posing, although I don't know what it is.
Okay.
And this is the thing that I wrestle with. Okay, there's the sort of old school, whether you see it in esotericism, like with the uptight Steinerians, and of course with much, you know, most, almost all of Christianity in a lot of ways, and other, you know, traditional ways, there's this reticence about the body and repression, and, you know, we're familiar with that story. And then there's this kind of, you know, release of the body and sexuality, celebration of sexuality, and there's this kind of spiritual reaffirmation. And we, you know, you can see that growing up out of the counterculture, and, you know, it has earlier roots, of course, but then, you know, becomes part of the way in which people sort of celebrate the body and they celebrate sexuality. And on one level, you know, if you look at that kind of rhetoric, it's often what's celebrated is this kind of very light expression of sexuality. You know, it's about love and tasting and enjoyment and play and, you know, a kind of childlike exuberance and opportunity for intimacy and all this kind of stuff. Great, that's fine. But, you know, most people, I wouldn't say, I can't generalize about everybody, I would say most people in their explorations of sexuality realize that there's some very intense stuff in there. There's some very dark stuff. There's stuff about power. There's stuff about fear. There's stuff about, you know, naughtiness. There's stuff about what you shouldn't. There's taboo. There's excess. There's blood. There's all sorts of mess in there. And that's the part where I'm going, okay, so you got your spiritual sort of attempt to affirm sexuality as part of a spiritual life. But I think that there are deeper contradictions and opportunities for insight that most people just kind of cover over. You know what I mean? And I think that the difficulty with pornography helps us illuminate that, because it's one thing to say, oh, I celebrate sexuality as part of my spiritual life. Great. But are you able to include whatever, hardcore pornography in that? And it's like, oh, no, that's degrading. That's
right.
That's whatever. That's the bad part of sexuality. And where I look, and I'll shut up, the way I look, I go, It's really, I mean, sexuality is a trick, because if you try to make a division between good or healthy sexuality and bad and unhealthy sexuality, all you've done is just intensify sexuality, because sexuality is always looking for, like, bad sexuality that it can kind of, like, loop into the game to make it more good. So it's a real tricky, sticky realm that I don't hear people really standing up for very well. And I think that your thoughts on pornography here and larger help illuminate this very tricky issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think two things as you're speaking. And one is that, like, sex is more like sex in general is sort of like the sort of guilt and shame dump for all sorts of other social ills and anxieties. Like, it just all sort of gets rerouted into sex. It's like it really is like misdirection in a lot of ways, like what people feel badly about in their lives, like they'll put on sex. And some of that is because a path to sex has been sort of cut by people in power for all sorts of reasons, to control people, all that sort of stuff. So, that's a whole big subject. But also because sex is a place where we can sort of reenact things that might not be so healthy in our lives in a healthy way, and in a sort of a way that provides us with a good framework. Now, let me sort of add to that with another broader point, which will hopefully illuminate those two a little bit more, which is that, sex is, in my opinion, the most individualized thing about anybody. So, and why do I say this? It's a human being interacting with another human being. Just sort of at a base level, that has to happen during sex, or you interact with yourself if it's masturbation. But it's also, you have all the cultural forces, all the social forces, the psychological forces, all the aesthetic forces, all the forces of what your body has been shaped to look like by your, sort of genetic inherited stuff, and also, you know, the choices you've made for yourself and your karma and all that. It's like sex is this bizarre nexus where everything about the human experience meets. So it's entirely subjective. And I think this is something that makes it very difficult for spiritual people to talk about, because spiritual people like to very often come up with giant rules about how everything's supposed to be. And so what looks healthy, what is healthy for one person to do sexually might be totally unhealthy for somebody else, even if it's the exact same act. And that could mean, like, someone getting choked during sex is extremely healthy for someone because of their history, their predilections, the things they enjoy. It could be extremely cathartic. It could be very arousing. And for someone else, it could be a reenactment of trauma. So it's like you can't, from the outside, it's impossible to judge someone else's sex and sexuality because it's so highly individualized. And I do think that that's what makes it particularly troublesome for people, because they want to judge it, but it also makes it particularly troublesome for people who are in power, because, if sex is so individualized, then it's an expression of individuality. And so, people who are in power don't want a bunch of, individuals running around expressing themselves individually.
Well, that's the thing that I don't understand, is that sexuality runs by the same rules that any of our meat suit activities do, which include eating. So it's like, I just always go to the one man's meat is another man's poison. Like you say, it's so individualized, just like any activity that we participate in. If you're going to run a marathon, that's not healthy for everyone, depending on, like you said, their individual characteristics. So to me, like, I don't understand how people somehow include sexual activity, which is governable by laws,
right,
by the way, like, right? So there's those activities that you participate with your physical body are actually governable and punishable by laws of state, whereas they don't make laws like that you can only eat certain things. I mean, unless you're in a religious country and you do like kosher or halal, where a lot of those spiritual laws come down and attach the body, right? So like you're saying, spiritual people freak out because they like to have laws governing, you know, behavior on all of our mitzvah activities. And I feel like it extends to all of those. And if you're going to be super gnarly, then you kind of have to, like, be some kind of, you know, religious zealot almost with it.
Right. I mean, and I think that sex is a little, how shall I say, I don't know if I want to say closer to the ground or how to exactly say it. But, I mean, I think sex is people interacting with other people in a way that, you know, you're right. I mean, all those things are highly individualized. Like, you know, if I look at a painting, it's something. But with sex, it's like, you know, it's very different because you're meeting someone in total individuality with all their insecurities, all their blah, blah, blah. So it's like, I think that sex requires a sort of act of compassion that maybe, you know, to fully embrace it, that maybe some of these other things do not require quite as much. And so I think it's more threatening in that sense. And I think if you look at dictatorships in other countries, one of the first things they often do is regulate sex. And then they also regulate the kinds of people you can have sex with. And then they do things like execute all the homosexuals or whatever, you know. So I do think it has to do something with the act of compassion that fully embraced sex really requires. I mean, compassion for yourself and compassion for others and understanding of others and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah.
All right. Well, this is all really good stuff. We're going to have to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Connor Habib, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're talking with Eric Davis and Connor Habib about science and pornography. Two things that go together surprisingly well. Before the break, you were talking about the role that compassion plays. And this, I wonder, like, in your opinion, as someone who, you know, this is a pretty big part of your life, or at least a part of your life that you participate in actively, what do you think, in your ideas, is necessary for us to be able to make some kind of evolution or progress to alleviate some of these discompassionate or restrictive or dictatorly rules that people apply to the sexuality of individuals? What do you think would be necessary to kind of like make some giant shift there to try to level that out a little bit?
I mean, I think there are lots of things that we can do. I mean, they're beyond just sort of on the ground activism work, which I think is really important to protect sex workers, to protect women's rights, to protect bodily rights, all that sort of stuff. I think also just sort of not accepting anything without exploring the history that's been inherited with it. So, I mean, you know, exploring where shame from sex comes from. Like, you know, when you have some sort of knee-jerk reaction to something sexually, whether it's pornography or masturbation or people, like someone telling you that they have a rape fantasy or something like that, about, like, instead of just being like, oh, no, that's wrong or whatever, you know, and maybe one of those things that I listed, you know, for the people who are listening caused that reaction in you, you can say, okay, why do I feel like this? Is there a force in history that's taught me to feel like this? Can I investigate that a little bit more? So contextualizing that kind of stuff. And I also just think, really, and this is the project of Rudolf Steiner Anthroposophy, is thinking about your own thinking. So when a thought arises, about sex, you know, not just contextualizing history, but thinking, why do I think that? Where did that idea come from? Why am I applying that thought to other people instead of just myself? You know, is that helpful to other people or not? Can I ask other people about it? So, I mean, they're just sort of general, they're more generalized things that would help us in almost any situation, but I think sex causes such strong and immediate reactions in people that it's particularly important to do that in the realm of
sex. Another way I think of talking about that is that rather than, you know, the attempt to sort of simply spiritually affirm
sexuality, is to recognize that the complexities and the paradoxes and the challenges of it are a wonderful opportunity for understanding yourself and understanding yourself emotionally, where you're coming from, and that through that process you almost inevitably open up and see the world in a richer, more open, more multidimensional way. And one thing that that I was thinking about, because another thing I wanted to talk about here is about the internet and pornography, and you know, from any, you know, from your being a porn star online and da da da, but the whole way that the internet has transformed the discussion and the experience of pornography for everybody in ways that I think we do a very poor job of really trying to take into account. And I'd love to hear some of your responses, but I just want to throw one idea out there, that one of the interesting things about pornography online is that it's really easy to access other people's pornography. Like, when you're going to buy, like, magazines, or you're trying to find, or whatever the thing is, back in the day, you know, videos, whatever, it's like, yeah, I'm just going to, you know, you're just going to go for what you're interested in. But point, you're like, yeah, I can look at this Tumblr, and now I'm looking at this Tumblr, and, oh, wait, now I'm in a realm where this is not my flavor.
Right.
But to stay there and go, wow, check it out. Like, there's something really powerful and strange and uncanny about other people's fetishes or other people's fixations. They're fascinating because they're like, you can see the way it's kind of like your trip, but it's not, but it is, but it's not. And that very process helps, like, I think, you know, broaden the mind and broaden your own sense, and even have a more like objective sense of your own, not objective exactly, but a different angle on what makes you run as well, as opposed to just going, I like that, I like that, no, I don't like that, I don't like that. I mean, it's like kind of an idiot response. It's like it broadens the whole field. So in that way, again, I think the quote-unquote objectification that is part of pornography can actually help open up and de-objectify your own view of what's going on and what drives people.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. I think what happens is it creates a sort of sense of detachment, you know, a healthy detachment, not sort of not separation, but a sense of detachment from your own sort of desire matrix or whatever, you know, to do something like that. And I think, you know, it's something that I notice in myself, having done so many porn scenes with people that I wasn't necessarily physically attracted to, but just sort of getting into the mindset to be able to perform anyway with these people and trying to have, like, enter into a sexual space with them, really sort of detached me from a lot of my own sort of preconceptions and my sort of narrow ideas of what I was attracted to. And I think that happens with a lot of people who are sex workers. So what you're talking about sort of the at-home game version of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you're playing on a larger field.
Yeah, so I mean, I think, like, you know, this is also this thing that happens with lots of sex workers, where you become sort of detached from your intense attachments to what it is exactly that you like and what you always need. And that's why there are certain European countries that have been encouraging prostitutes to work in hospice care, because there are people who have become detached enough from the body to not be repulsed by any aspect of the body, so they can care for people who are dying.
Well, this is very fascinating. I really feel like this touches on a really important point when we're talking about spirituality and sexuality, because one of the results of pornography, I feel like, is that the people watching it become detached from their partners and themselves sexually. Because it's funny, like you said, the sex workers become detached, and weirdly, then the effect that it has magically and sorcerer style on other people is they get, you know, what we call in a cult the phantasmagoria, where someone will be having sex with their girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, and they're not thinking about their girlfriend or boyfriend, they're thinking thinking about the pornography that they just watched. And so they're not even thinking about what they like or what they feel or what they're doing. Instead, their brain is somewhere detached from the entire situation and their thoughts have gone there. But it's fascinating from your perspective, from the sex worker, that you guys would, like, in order for you guys to do that, maybe it's not always your ideal situation. And so if part of the effect of that does kind of break you out of that, my question for you is, have you or seen other people in the sex industry be able to kind of come out the other side of that and be able to totally, like, concentrate and exist in those moments where they're participating, or is everybody just kind of on autopilot?
It's a complex, I would never say it's autopilot. I would always say that when you're doing sex work, it's sort of like a sport where you have to be in your body and out of your body at the same time. Like, you have to get in that zone. And so I almost think, I'm not totally willing to commit to this statement yet, but I almost think that sex is like the sexual energy is like, it's something that it is itself like totally detached from desire in a weird way. I'm starting to think that a little bit. Like, you can enter into a sexual space with anything, which is why people like, I mean, you know, these, like, there's like that documentary about like the person who fell in love with the Eiffel Tower, or like the people who sexualized, you know, their pillows or whatever. I mean, I think that sexual energy is like sort of its own thing, and you filter certain desires into it. So I'm starting to think, like, I guess to answer your question, it's like, it can go either way. And the fact of the matter is, we don't really have any training in how to make it go the right way, you know? And so that's part of what I'm trying to explore, is to help people feel totally open in their sexuality and in, like, their use of their sexual energy rather than constrained by it. And so for some people, pornography is extremely, opening. Like, they watch porn with their partners, you know, to get turned on. Or they... I mean, let's not just take it to the partner level. They watch porn and they learn about sex. I mean, I know for me, watching gay pornography as a kid growing up in small town Pennsylvania was like, oh, wow, like, gay people have fun having sex, and it's not like the worst thing in the world, and, you know, I don't have to hate myself anymore. Like, that was awesome for me. So, like, there are all sorts of ways in which it can open, and then there are the ways that you're talking about in which it can become compulsive. But I'm starting to think that maybe that's... it's like some sort of separate thing from the actual sexual center. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, because we can do that with our thoughts, too. It's like, you're like walking down the street to, you know, go buy an apple or something, you know, totally innocent or whatever, and you're like, I didn't pay that fucking bill. I didn't pay that bill. I didn't pay that bill. And, like, you know, you're obsessing over this thing, and so you're not present because you're in a state of, like, weird anxiety. And that sort of sounds like the thing you're describing when you talk about someone having sex with their partner and, like, just thinking about the pornography. You know, it's like a weird anxiety that's located in your sexual chakra instead of,
angle on it too, which I think is maybe I'm not exactly sure where to go with it, but when you take in that example of like, oh, the partner's in bed and one of them is just thinking about the porn they'd seen, you know, and obviously that's not a particularly desirable situation, but in a way it's not unrelated to something more basic about sexuality per se, or at least the way that we experience sexuality, which is that there's a fantasy component to all sex. So it's even, you know, you're having that intimate thing and you're staring in the eyes and you're connecting. This person is great, but they're still kind of magical too. It's like magical. It's enchanted in that moment. Even that intense moment with your partner, that enchantment is not the same thing as your partner. It's like a spell. I mean, there's some kind of, and that's part of the mysticism here of sexuality is also partly that in sexual experience, there's this kind of invocation that we enjoy by the intensity, by the pleasure, by the fantasy, by the way that it echoes through our own personal history or reminds us of dreams, or, you know, there's all these sort of other elements that are in the room that are not just our partner. So even though
I like how Connor called it sexual energy, and it's just there present, and you kind of like dial it in by engaging, right?
Right, and that's, I mean, I want to say, and then, yes, to that, and then to what you just said, Eric, like, I mean, I think it's also, like, let's just sort of, well, you don't have to go there with me, but I'm just going to say it. Let's just sort of get rid of this idea that one partner is going to be able to satisfy us for the rest of our lives when we have a partner, right? So then what does the sexual act turn into? Well, either you end up not having sex with a person at all, or it's this, like, thing where you have to sort of stimulate, like, the sexual energy in yourself and find a way to meet your partner there. And for a lot of people, like, wouldn't it be great if, like, we got to the point where we're comfortable enough with our partners to be like, look, we're not really, like, feeling this for each other's bodies or whatever exactly anymore, but, like, I have my sexual desires, you have your sexual desires, I love you, so, like, I'm going to be thinking about this while you masturbate me, or, like, I'm going to be, like, imagining this, like, while we have sex. Like, if we could just sort of talk openly about that, it would be hugely different, because we're so defensive, like, oh, you were thinking about something else for, like, 1 second while we were having sex. And that, you know, and it's like, well, of course I was. Like, not only was I thinking about, like, you know, having sex with someone else for a minute, I was also thinking about, like, all the shit I have to do tomorrow. And I was thinking about, you know, whatever, like, this idea of, like, being immersed in the sexual experience with one person. I actually think that that's a lie that we've been sold. I don't really buy that. I mean, I think it happens sometimes, and it's awesome when it happens. But I think more often than not, when we're having sex, we're thinking. And the idea that we should not be thinking while we're having sex is this thing that actually has been used to control sex, because it tells us that certain sexual experiences are totally preferable, and the only way that we can ever have that kind of sexual experience is to have it with a loving partner, and the only way we can have a loving partner is if we get married to somebody and stay with them for the rest of our lives. So I think,
well,
that
I feel like that goes back to what you said about the Rudolf Steiner stuff, which is think about what you're thinking about, right? Watch thoughts. And certainly, like, we're going to be thinking, and sex, I mean, you know, sex mostly happens in your brain anyway. So it's going to be, like, more, I feel like when you get into spiritual sexuality, it's really more about directing your thoughts in that department. And like you said, maybe it's not going to be surrounded totally on the beloved or by objectifying the person you're with, right? Now we get back to that again. So then what is the best way then to have healthy, I don't want to say good or bad, but healthy, or, you know, that kind of desirable sex is going to be like, think about, use your thinking, right?
Right. Yeah, I think totally. I think it's the... and thinking about your thinking will sometimes mean being totally open and honest with the person that you're with. Sometimes it'll mean that you are just deciding to inhabit a certain role when you go into a sexual experience, even if you don't necessarily tell your partner that. Like, well, this time I'm going to be, like, a little more dominating or a little more submissive or whatever. Sometimes it's going to mean... I mean, it can mean a whole lot of things, but basically what it boils down to is trying to be intentional, so rather than compulsive.
Right.
And so I think that that's what I would hope for everybody, is that they're making real free decisions when they enter into, well, anything, but, you know, particularly my concern for, you know, these past few years has been sex, so... Yeah.
No, that question around compulsion seems true, because compulsion seems to be something that, if from a lot of different angles, psychological, personal, in our relationship to substances, to food, to whatever, like, compulsion is the point where it's probably not what we really want to be going down. Which doesn't mean the thing itself. It's about the attitude, the opposite, which is kind of like the opposite of intentionality. And it seems like that's the part of what happens in sex with I mean, a partner, not meaning a long-term partner, but is that you kind of, like, create an environment where the other person is able to go through their own compulsiveness, and that by you creating a space of intentionality around that, the whole thing, you know, goes in the right direction, as opposed to two mutually compulsive, you know, actings out, like, that's going to burn out. It might be fun, but it's going to burn out, and it might end up just leaving everyone bereft and unhappy. But
well, that's so fascinating, Eric, because a lot of people, in my experience, I get a lot of people coming to me with their relationship problems, right? And a lot of the things I notice is that the reason relationships fall apart is because only one person is catering to the other person's compulsion, and then they don't get it back the other way.
Yeah.
Right. That's a good way to put it. And I also just want to say, like we should give ourselves, everybody needs to give themselves a little bit of a break when it comes to sexual compulsion, whether it's, feeling badly because you jerked off, five times yesterday or because you looked at too much porn or whatever. It's okay, set that down. Set down your sexual compulsion and all your fear about your sexual compulsions, because people obsess about it all the time. Why am I attracted to this woman? Oh, my gosh, I'm married and I'm attracted to this girl I work with or whatever. Constantly obsessing over it. It's put that aside and, why don't you look at the compulsion that's happening in the rest of your life for a little bit? Why do you have this job that you're not happy going to? Why do you feel like you have to behave in all these other sorts of ways? Why are you, so stressing about, your student loan bill, all that kind of stuff. Give sex just a little bit of a break and look at all the other factors in your life where you're compulsive, because we tend, like I said, sex becomes sort of a dump for shame and guilt about other things. And doing that, just setting aside and being you know what, it's all right. It's the least of my worries should probably be about this self-generating pleasure entity that I have in my body that I can access whenever I want. And why don't I look at some other things first? And giving it a break helps you sort of, free yourself up from all the tangles and the knots. It's you get more entangled the more you struggle sometimes. So give yourself a rest and look at compulsion elsewhere in your life for a little bit too,
I think that's fine advice. We're winding up here, and I wanted to talk a little bit about your experience recently where you were giving a going to give a talk at a school, and they got canceled on you because of your porn starness. And I'm just kind of curious, how you as you grow into being a public figure, not just somebody that people might recognize from films, but who's talking about sex, who's talking about anthroposophy, how the experience of becoming a public person who is a porn star, but not just a porn star, how that's revealing things to you about the way we are right now in terms of talking about porn, talking about the internet, talking about the way these things relate with our lives. What are you learning from this experience?
Wow, no one's ever asked me that question. I don't know that I've ever even asked myself that question directly. I think something that I'm seeing, and maybe I have a self-selecting audience, but I don't think so, is that people are way more open than we think. It's we keep talking about sex as if we're not ready to talk about it, but in fact I think a lot of people are more and more ready to talk about it. And why? Because I've just received so many voices of support and everything, and when I decide to just come and talk about sex, people are ready for it. They really want to talk about it. And they're really interested in it. And so I think that's something I'm learning. I think also, the time is now. I mean, things are ready. But the other thing I'm learning is, I'm learning a lot about myself and my own sort of difficulty and overcoming, even as a sort of sexually sophisticated person, I'm learning about my own difficulty in coming to terms with the choices that I've made. I'm really proud and happy with everything I've done, but when I go and talk about anthroposophy, to anthroposophists, I gave a talk at a nonprofit anthroposophical organization, and I remember having a sit down talk with the director and being well, are they going to be okay that I'm in porn? And nobody cared. So I have my own stuff, where I expect people to sort of backlash in a way that very often that they don't. And then, of course, then they do. The college thing you're talking about is invited to speak at a college. They signed the contract, and then the president flipped out at the nth hour and did cancel the talk, but they paid me anyway. I spoke in the town anyway. More people came than would have come if, I came. But So there are still all those prejudices, and they just rise and fall. I mean, I think what I'm learning right now, too, is that there are a million different ways to go to war with sex. And they all seem to stem from a similar bizarre impulse of power and control, and I'm seeing that everywhere. Whether it's a certain wave of feminism, whether it's religious fundamentalism, whether it's now evolutionary biologists have sort of jumped into the fray, or people claim to be evolutionary biologists at least by talking about brain chemicals and, you know, compulsory porn addiction, that sort of stuff, media theorists, all this. It all sort of like seems to come from the same weird spiritual well to me. And so I think that that enemy is just going to be there with us for a long time. But it's, I'm noticing it come up in a lot of different ways. And it's always just seems to sneak in and find its way somehow to control people when it comes to sex. So I'm learning that as well. I don't know.
But I really think that what you said about trying to be free in your thinking when you're having, I feel like that's a really good antidote to all that, because no one can control you. Like you said, if you have that shame and feel like you have to check and see if you're okay, like, is it okay that I do this? Now you're being controlled, right? So if you can take those thoughts and just have that freedom and have it be part of you, yes, people can try and exert their power over you, but then in a more like kind of Gandhi, Martin Luther King way, if you can maintain that within yourself, you'll always have that kind of freedom.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. I hope I can pull that off.
Well, that's wonderful. We just got a minute left here. Could you want to let people know where they can find out more about you online?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best thing to do if you want to be directed to adult or non-adult content is just to follow me on Twitter. So it's just at Connor Beebe, C-O-N-N-E-R-H-A-B-I-B. And that you can link to my blog, or I can send you to, you know, the other stuff. And then also I have the course on Volver Learning Lab on the 22nd, and so that's evolverlearninglabs.com, and that's my anthroposophy course, just an introduction to Rudolf Steiner and how that intersects with freedom, really. So I feel like I might be...
Yeah, well, there's so much stuff we didn't get to, man. I had that was one of the things on the list.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I've got to get you back soon.
Okay,
all right,
awesome.
Connor, thanks so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks to both of you. Thanks so much.
All right, from me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.